presents Workplace Encounters Part 4, Guarding a 10 by 10 Foot Room, and You. Well, hello there. I'm the Dungeon Wizard. I know all the secrets. The secret rooms, the trap locations, and all the treasures. Do you know the biggest secret of all? Well, you ought to, because it's no secret that the customer is number one. Now, most of the time, most of the folks in most of my dungeons understand that. But Azalyn Dungeonscapes is the fastest growing monster and relic storage business in the Bi-County area, and there's always someone new to train. Today, we're paying a visit to our newest worker, Burgash Bloodear. Burgash has all the marks of a great new Dungeonscapes employee. He's a brutish orc dimwit with his own axe, and he's non-union. Just like you folks, he's been assigned to stand watch in a 10 by 10 foot room with one door. Let's see how he's doing now.
Two scorpions on the same stick? Broke Tooth, you truly are a character. Let's grab some filthy grog after closing time. I'll see you next time you wander past.
A violation? Stop!
What? Who was that? Is there a mysterious voice in here?
Burgash, do you know the 5 secrets to effective dungeon landscape management?
Well, no, but mister, who are you?
I'm the Dungeon Wizard. I'm here to teach you the secrets and practices you'll need to make sure the customer is number one. And you're breaking secret rule number one for 10 by 10 foot room guardians right now.
Secret rule? That seems like an inefficient training strategy.
Never you dang mind. Secret rule number one. Never talk to the wandering monsters.
But Broketooth is a friendly kobold. He brought me a good berry he found on a dead druid in level 3.
Broketooth has one job, to make sure the customers stay number one. Do you know what that job is?
Traps?
Well, yes, traps. Two. He has 2 jobs.
I know he also dusts the wainscoting over in the armory.
He has to wander.
Why?
A dungeon without wandering monsters is an empty, confusing experience. Customers in a wandering monster-free dungeon won't stick around to get eaten in the Otiug pit traps. They might just leave and head to a TCBY for a Frogurt. With toppings. Next thing you know, they're pogo-balling down Sunset in their bum equipment sweaters and their members-only jackets, and they're not patronizing our establishment.
Hang on, is this an 80s thing? Why am I just an orc then? Shouldn't I be at least a cool 80s orc with shoulder pads and a car phone?
What? No.
Maybe I could wear a swatch, get some bugle boys.
Secret rule number 2, not to question the premise of the bit. Now, let's talk about rule number 3. Do you have a treasure chest in your 10 by 10 foot room?
Yeah, I've been using it as a chair. Hey, do you know what's in there? I'm super curious about that.
Never question the contents of the chest. Secret rule number 3 for 10 by 10 foot room guardians is simple. The chest belongs to the customer. You stay out of there.
But if it contains useful magical equipment, wouldn't that be helpful to, you know, slay adventurers with?
Well, yeah, probably. But look, in this bit, I think the adventurers are customers, so we don't want to kill them, Oh, dang it, you've got me questioning secret rule number 2. You're on thin ice, Burgash.
I'm just saying, if there's a wand of fireballs in there, I could be blasting fools with it instead of sitting on it.
Secret rule number 4. No union talk. This is a non-union shop we're running, and I swear, Burgash, if I see as much as literature sticking out of your locker, I will shut this whole operation down and get a Benetton in here so fast you won't notice how fast you switch to folding sweaters.
To be honest, I think I'd probably prefer to fold sweaters. I wouldn't get killed by a halfling, and I'm pretty sure those guys get breaks.
Secret rule number 5. Never, and I mean never, leave your post. Never.
Actually, I meant to ask about that. This room is pretty spare. There's 4 walls, 1 door, and a chest. I've kinda needed to go to the bathroom for like 3 days now. You're not my supervisor, right? You're just like a floating voice.
Why, yes. I'm the Dungeon Wizard. I know all the secrets of effective dungeon landscape.
Great. Look, man, I'll level with you. I've been going in the chest. I know, I broke secret rule number 3 or whatever. But there were some scrolls in there. They're still in there, but I wouldn't want to loot them.
So you're guarding a box full of orc excretions in a room that smells like orc excretions.
Well, yeah, now.
Perfect. Here at Azalyn Dungeonscapes, we aspire to provide a perfect dungeon experience to all our customers, each and every day, to make sure they're always number one.
Hey, could you go? I need to stash some goods in the chest.
Now you, too, know the secrets of proper dungeon landscape management. We'll see you next week for Encounters Part 5. Monsters that pretend to be furniture and walls and stuff. It's a living.
I'm serious, man. This is a treasure type 2 situation.
And welcome to Afterthoughts. As always, I am Jeff. My co-host John is here with me. This is the companion podcast to System Mastery, where every other week we get together and talk about whatever the heck we want. John, how are you this week?
So good. Full of the tastiest of Persian foods.
Oh, man. That's Kubi Day and kofta kebabs from the little place just down the street from us.
Oh, yeah.
Spectacular.
That good rice.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they didn't hit us up with the tadig the way I like. You know, that's that chunk
crispy.
Of like... That crispy rice from the bottom of the pan. I think it's because we were like their first customers.
Yeah.
That no one, they had yet to burn any rice to serve out to people.
They had yet to crisp up the bottom.
Yeah. So folks, this week we are joined by a special guest, which is why we had to eat healthy Persian food instead of our usual disgusting hamburgers. We have Kalom on with us. He is the host of the Rollists podcast, a podcast out of London. Kalom, say hello.
Hello. Hello, everybody. Hello, listeners of System Mastery.
So, what we are doing this week is, Kalom was the person who sent us a recommendation for the episode we did last week. And John, remind me what the heck that was.
That was Nephilim.
That's right, Nephilim. So Nephilim is a French language podcast, or sorry, French language role-playing game. And that's why it was a recommendation, I believe. Kalom here is a first language French speaker.
Yes, I am indeed. And I think I must start with a major cop-out about the episode is that I never actually played the game you read, which is the English translation, which might, I think a lot of your criticism might still apply to the French game, but maybe some things were skewed through the translation.
Well, I think notably the last paragraph of the book, which...
Oh my God.
It gave us a new set of rules for a villain who was a Nephilim that used to be Hitler. That was really interesting. I mean... It was just sort of fun for us. We were shocked. Usually, I mean, normally, most games will leave Hitler out of it. Like, the vampires, the werewolves, they'll all say, okay, almost every important villain in the history of the world is actually a vampire or a werewolf or a ghost or whatever this game is about, but not Hitler. And the reason it's usually not Hitler is because they want to leave this story open for how it's about the evils of man, like that men are the real evil. That's why Hitler was a human. The other reason is because you don't want to give Hitler an ideology that's drawn from your game.
Yeah, definitely. And again, not only I never played the English first edition of Nephilim, I played mostly the second edition, and I reread it recently because I ran it for my own show this week. Mm-hmm. So it will be interesting to compare. But the French second edition made a point to say that Adolf Hitler, there was nothing... linking Adolf, you can be incarnated during World War II, you can do stuff there, but it's specified that Adolf Hitler, there's no reason to think that that person was a Nephilim.
Believe me, we're not upset about it. We thought it was hilarious.
Let's discuss that for an hour and a half.
It was we just thought it was the funniest thing. I mean, it's just a rare thing. Usually games just don't even try. He's kind of the don't touch this of role-playing games. But now you're saying that you've primarily played the second edition French version of a game, and what we reviewed was the first edition English version?
Yes, and interestingly, totally out of random, before suggesting it to you, I ran into one of the translators, the people who worked on the translation from French to English at Chaosium of that first edition. Mm-hmm. This person happens to be Kenneth Haidt.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought Kenneth Haidt was involved in the translations. Yeah, from the big podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff. Nope, I'm sorry, that's right.
Yeah, that's right. And one thing about my own show is that I'm the least knowledgeable person in the tabletop RPG industry. So I go speak to people without really knowing who they are. So, but Kenneth Hyde, I checked him up on Wikipedia when I was at Dragonmead, and I realized that he translated Nephilim, and that was the only thing I was really caring about, and his work on Star Trek. Mm-hmm. But I recorded this conversation, which will be soon online, and he mentioned something which you mentioned also, which I thought was interesting, and it's difficult to tell how much it might have shaped the English version, but he said himself that he would have preferred to play a Templar rather than a Nephilim, because the Nephilim sounded like villains above all.
That's funny. So that is roughly what we said.
That is the exact same criticism I had of it, is that, I mean, just from my perspective, the Nephilim are these possessing entities that take over people and have weird agendas, and then you've got the secret society that's fighting against it. And generally, as a human, you'd be like, oh, I can more identify with someone fighting against this like horrible oppressive spirit than you can with a weird magical being.
So let me ask... go ahead.
Let me just ask a question regarding that, because... first of all, I think the English translation, I have no proof of it. I cannot really appreciate it, because when I do read the first edition English, there's so much background I got with the game which shaped the way I read things. So it's very difficult for me to be entirely blank and objective regarding what's written in it. And again, I'm not sure to what extent the people translating it make that even worse in that translation, this villain thing. But nonetheless, I would have the question... is Vampire the Masquerade less popular than Hunter?
Well, interesting question.
Because a vampire is something awful. And even to some extent, I would say in Dungeons & Dragons, even when you play humans, I mean, murder hobos are a big classic. And so is it the exciting part to play first the good guys all the time? The way scenarios, I know the way it was run with the people who introduced me to the game, and the way I run it is that I try to keep a conflict with the character, who are some of them, not all of them, some Nephilim are fine with enslaving and possessing humans, and some others have issues with that, and we'll try to find ways to go around it. And they curse to do that, and they don't like it. But so that's what I would have to say on the subject.
Well, I can tell you, Vampire is definitely a lot more popular than Hunter. I mean, it, more or less, not just because it came out first, but because Vampire is a lot of fun. I think it does a great job of presenting charming, likable villains. For some people, I'm actually not a huge vampire fan.
I think the big thing with that is, I mean, a lot of the times with, especially any of the White Wolf or the other like monster based ones, for the most part, you're still you just wrestle with something. So you're still who you are. It's just now you're a vampire and you have to like wrestle with the beast inside of you, or, you know, you're a human and you find out you're a werewolf and then you have to deal with that. Whereas I think with Nephilim, it being that the spirit goes into a guy's body or whoever, and then just, that's it, they're in charge now. I think that is the aspect that really comes across as being more sinister.
I could see that. I mean, I never really, the whole premise with the Nephilim coming off as villains was never really my core complaint with it. I mean, I don't mind playing games where humans are just fodder. There are plenty of games like that out there. I would say that my primary concern was that it was hard to gauge motive. Mm-hmm. Our big complaint about it, I think, in general was, you know, you could play this game, but to what end? What's the goal? What are we trying to do here?
Well, the thing is, a big, it's slightly related, but in what you were saying about the game, it seemed like when you were playing a Nephilim, you would know all of what has been going on. You would know all the secret history which would have been going on. You know, you know that this guy was a Nephilim and this other guy was a Nephilim and this thing is a lie to the humans, etc. And the first thing we did, the bit which is exciting with the game, usually when I discuss it with other people, is that actually you're a Nephilim who happened to take part to a few things over the course of history, but has no clue what happened the rest of the time, has no clue what happened in other places, and is very struggling. So I think the first concept of Nephilim, which makes it exciting, is that they're actually not that powerful. I mean, you mentioned yourself that the magic power are rather crappy. And it definitely played a part in the game. I master even this week the fact that, okay, I can do this, which is awfully specific and not that useful. And so in terms of powers, the Nephilim are, as individuals, are definitely not that powerful. As societies in the games I've been playing, it's usually described that Templars, Mysteries, and other secret societies which are run by the humans are actually the one being in charge. And the way the history is described, I don't know how things might have been played by other people in other places, but the way things are played is that over the course of history, well, first of all, the Nephilim lost a lot at the beginning. They used to be much more powerful. So they were hunted, quite simply. So you're playing a character who's literally being hunted by the humans as a filthy creature. It's really not Vampire the Masquerade, where the Masquerade really controls the structure of power. That's something the Templars actually do. And there are Nephilim trying specifically to try to go against that. And you mentioned the Emperor. That's what they do. So you're hunted. You're not in charge, and you're trying to survive. You cannot really stay in your corner and do nothing, because quite quickly you're gonna have a squad of Templars who are running around. And in terms of stuff, we mentioned Hitler, but in terms of the way the game is described, usually in the French scenarios, Templars are definitely fascistic figures. So, so I know, and I was checking. I got right here the supplement for the Templars, and I was looking at it. I was wondering if, because Kenneth Hyde mentioned that, and I think you mentioned that too, that you have liked a supplement where you could create a Templar character. I checked the French version. There's not even the option for you to play a Templar. There's another supplement for you to play a Selenim. But when you read the Templars, they are always very powerful people behind governments, and often rather fascistic, and often they are in power, and you are the one who's got to hide from them to do whatever you want to do. So in that, again, you can be a Nephilim who hates humans for that and will kill them blindly, or you can be a Nephilim who thinks that actually doing stuff with human is the secret to actually the thing which usually leads all the scenarios, which is the Agatha. The Nephilim are just 1% of what they used to be in terms of individual power. So the whole thing is you want to go to this Agatha, which numerically is this 90k level, but that's certainly not something you do in the game, in the French scenario, by just rolling dice. You get ka by being the witness of fantastical events, or finding historic objects, old artifacts, and this sort of things. And when you're the witness of that, usually, well, then, since it's an old game, etc., you roll on a table, and there's good chances that you're gonna earn really a lot of ka from that experience. And that, and learning secret. It's really a secret game, actually. You go through the game trying to understand what really happened through history, what's really happening now, what are the powers fighting against each other. Do you join one of these powers to fight another one? Is the power you join very good for you and for your beliefs as a Nephilim? And that's that's part of the excitement of the game.
Okay. So the way you're describing it, I actually have a couple of questions that are coming up from that. Because one of the things that left me, I don't necessarily feel like I need to play as a Templar, but I wanted to understand more about how they operate.
Yep.
And one of the questions that was brought up for me is, there's this kind of pervasive fear, and you're right, you know, vampires have their camarilla that basically controls the world, so vampires is mostly a game of, you know, making out in dark rooms. It's given up a lot of the horror in exchange for a lot of the romance. But there's another White Wolf game, Exalted, that has a lot of a Nephilim feel to it, where you're playing someone who's newly minted, and granted, their power scale's a little different, but from the moment you're born, you're hunted. There's a power structure that's out to get you. So there's similarities there. But the difference is they have a way to detect you in Exalted, and I'm wondering how it is that the Templars show up to your door right away, like the moment after you incarnate.
They might not show right away at your door. It's more what can you do without being noticed, especially nowadays. Okay. With all the surveillance. But then, and I think even in the edition you covered, it's described, you've got the metamorphosis, which the more powerful you grow, the more visible they are. But also, the more powerful a Templar might be, the more able that person will be to notice those signs.
So they have the car sight.
Yes. And
okay.
They don't have the car sight per se, actually. They just got a regular sight, but they will notice that there's this weird smell, this, which are supposed to be subtle, not straight away like they are describing the books, which are, if they were at maximum level. I think it describes something like, from a level 12 in those things, you start to be noticed around you. You're going to go check in at a hotel, and the guy's going to be like, this person's hair looks very weird, or there's something wrong with their eyes. And beyond, and obviously if it's a Templar, he will notice you. But Templar,
because he's trained to, that makes sense.
He's trained. And also there's all the secret societies, which are older than there's one which is older than the Templars, which are the mysteries, also calls the well, that's a good thing, actually, which I don't recall if it was in the book you covered. The very first human secret society, actually what happened in the story is that a Nephilim called Prometheus, again, that's picking on mythology, Nephilim who was Prometheus, who was not fine already to see the humans being treated as they were, and that was before the fall of that meteorite, etc. By the way, just explaining that, I tried to read the book. I reread the book, even the second edition. As a player, I don't read the background. That's something you find out as you play, and that's also part of the fun, because reading that story is dreadful. I mean, the dinosaurs, etc., are stuff very fun to find out about in-game, to find out, wait a minute, what is this dinosaur-like thing? And then you find out, well, there were dinosaurs before Nephilim, and you're like, what?
Yeah.
But reading the story is dreadful. But going back to the story, so this Nephilim was not happy, the humans being slaves, and just as in the Greek myth, Prometheus gave away secrets to the humans who started rebelling already against the Nephilim. And they are called the Mysteries, or the Swords of Prometheus, because these guys were the first who started to hunt the Nephilims. But at the same time, some of their subgroups integrated some Nephilims, some of them just killed them, some of them trapped the Nephilims in homunculus, so they are able themselves to use Nephilim artifacts, because they got a Nephilim trap in a bottle, literally, and they just draw on this like they would draw on any source of energy, which tortures the Nephilim who's in a little bottle at your belt. And those guys got loads of stuff to make themselves more powerful, to have a very strong solar car, and those guys are even more dangerous than the Templars. But they don't have the Templars. The concept is that they control the military, they control the governments. And then you got the Mysteries, which are much more older, who are more, they know more secrets about magic, etc., about the truth behind all that, why the Templars are mostly your typical conspiracy group in the background of a powerful figure who recently won an election, and that was quite weird, let's say.
Actually, the whole thing, it kind of makes it sound a lot like the Assassin's Creed series.
Yeah, yes. Well, I mean, there are even the Templars in there as well. So
it's exactly like that. And actually, you can play... I often play the game, even with the Nephilim, with the concept of remembering stuff which you did not remember. So I played stories where... What I really enjoyed personally with Nephilim, and something which is also mentioned, is first of all, you're able to play something through history, and and you can use this history to create your own stories. Personally, I got I think it's a bit of a professional deformation. I'm an architect, and when I create something, it's very difficult for me to start with a blank page, with not a starting point. I like to have a campaign and modify it. I can modify it a lot, but I need something to start with. So when you tell me you can do anything you want, I'm very lost by that. And in Nephilim, it tells you, well, you can do anything you want with history. But that means I can pick up a book about a specific time of history, or I can listen to a Hardcore History by Dan Carlin and start to think, wow, what story can I tell with that? And of course, you can be more or less obvious. Personally, I don't like the idea that every great figures in human history were Nephilim. So I find that stupid.
I wouldn't want to be like, okay, we've got a game and everyone who's playing in it, this guy was Napoleon and this guy was Caesar and so on.
Well, I feel like that's always going to be a problem for you, whether you're playing through history or playing through pop culture. If you have everyone in the backstory be part of this kind of grand mythology that's been pulled over it, then the game really becomes more about who knows the most about old world history trivia. Because I know some of our players would be going like, well, okay, that's not how Carthage went. We have to talk about the 12th century again, guys. I kind of like it as a sprinkling.
Yeah, but that's the fun thing. And actually, what I've heard, I didn't do that. Well, I listened recently to a French podcast who were talking about a Nephilim campaign they made. And they went as far as let players... Well, first of all, Nephilim much better in campaign than one shot, just saying. But,
yeah, makes sense.
But what they were explaining was that they allowed their players to use Wikipedia during the game. So if they would mention a figure of history, they would go to Wikipedia and find a Wikipedia page describing numbers of people that person would have known. And the game master would improvise stuff with that. So he had stuff pre-planned, stuff we improvised depending of the information in real time that the players were getting. But because of the structure of the idea itself of Nephilim, which is that actually the history is a lie. And to be fair, I'm not saying history is a lie, but sometimes we might think we know much more about what actually happened in places than actually was. So it's easy to say, well, yeah, but in ancient Rome, things were not like that. And in Nephilim, you can always fall back as a game master and say, well, that's what human history books say, or that's what the history books of the Mystère, if you go there, actually the Mystère history books say that what happened was that. Oh yeah, we found out that. Then you go two or three stories further and you find out that actually that was a lie as well. Because that's the thing. Even what's described in the background, what you read at the beginning, when I was playing it, I would run into a character who would tell me, no, that thing with Prometheus, that's BS. That's not true at all. And you'll be like, is that NPC lying to me, or is it true that this was a lie? You got layers and layers. You could even play in a very tight part of history and just revisit it with layers and layers of things. And that's the exciting part of the game. And supposedly it's the way Nephilim gather is by acquiring more knowledge and knowing more truth. And knowledge is power in that game, really.
Hmm.
That makes sense. You know, it's funny because you're selling me very efficiently on a version of the game that isn't the one we read, which, you know, isn't a bad thing. My first was thinking about how this game reminds me a little bit of Assassin's Creed. The first thing that came to mind was the part of Assassin's Creed that I hate is when I'm playing as either myself or Desmond. I don't care. I don't care about the modern day. I don't want to talk to a bunch of people in suits.
That's definitely not the part you would put in a movie, right?
Yeah, no, you would skip that, and certainly they did. Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry. They screwed that up and made it all about Michael Fassbender as a modern man for some reason. But I'm thinking, you know what would make a really fun campaign would be like pick a period in history where there were a great deal of luminaries who we still know about today, and then tell the story of them with a Nephilim layer pulled over it. Like the natural philosophers of the late 1600s or 1500s, when you had like Hooke and Newton and Leibniz and Morey and all these guys alive and basically building the building blocks of modern science all at once. Or World War II would have a lot of big historical names, or the American Revolutionary period. Those times where everyone knows the names of the people who were playing history at the time would make for good stories.
Yeah, but the thing with history, and again, that's something I often hear from French players and Belgian players, is that as you are playing it as a game master, you start reading more and more about those eras in which you decided to develop things, either by playing something contemporary in your story, but relating to that with your character finding the remnants of whatever they could, or even when you actually play within that era. So, but also even the players often would go and read not only history, but books about Kabbalah, books about alchemy, and it's really weird. It's a bit difficult to describe, but I don't know any game which the community was encouraged so much, encouraging itself so much into going to read a number of different books to feed into whatever they were doing. But the thing is, first of all, there's one campaign at least which exists, which plays in the times of Arthur.
Okay.
There's a second campaign which feed into that, where it's contemporary, but it definitely relates to that. So you can mix the two campaigns and jump from an era to another.
Mm-hmm.
So these are things which are there. And to give you an example of something which I mastered, what I did was at Players Incarnate, I created their character regularly, say, okay, you had three incarnations, pick whatever. I did not even bother to try to have the group to be consistent, having the players, the playing character know each other's beforehand, because the first story was you wake up, apparently your stuff were together, and the scenario was that they would find out that actually they had incarnation which they did not remember. So they would have flashbacks which we would play in the time of Venice, for instance. And they would realize that actually we used to be a team together. We just don't remember. And they would build their XP, they would spend it not to develop the skills they already had but to recover the memory of skills they had before, which in the end, technically, it's exactly the same. But story-wise, I thought it was interesting. And you got magical ways to travel through time. You got places which are stuck in time. You got places which are a fragment of legends of, like, in a game I ran into Lewis Carroll, and we were in a bit of Alice in Wonderland, and
no, that's fun,
and stuff like that. So actually you can play, you can do a lot of things with it, and it's a pity the game and you know, I was wondering as I was listening to you and
sure.
Going back to the core book of the second edition, I thought it raised an interesting question. It's a bit general with your show, but I was wondering to what extent, if I did had received that book, even the second edition French one, because again, a lot of the criticism you said could apply to that game. Hmm. If I did had read it on my own and trying to understand what it was about, rather than join a table and play it, would I have liked that game? Would I have seen that game the way I now see it the way I played it before reading it, the way most of the people I know in the community see it. I think it's an interesting question. To what extent a game book is not enough to transmit a game? If you read Dungeons & Dragons 3.5, does it contain all the hooks which everybody knows about before reading it?
Well, yeah, the big thing is, and I mean, we've said it on the show before, it's not even so much about the game being good or bad for a lot of people. It's really that you've played it with people that you like, and so you associate it with that. So a lot of the edition wars and stuff like that really boils down to, I played this game with my friends and had a good time, and so that's what I associate it as being good. And so you get things like, you know, people who are diehard fans of games that if all you were to do were take the book, sit down, read it, and look at the, you know, the mechanics and what it says in there for the background, you might go, that doesn't seem like a great game. But if you were to be introduced to it through friends and you sat down and really sort of organically came to the game and enjoyed what you were doing, sitting down having a good time, then of course you're going to think of it a lot better than you would of just finding a book and looking at it.
It's effectively impossible to judge a game entirely in a vacuum. You're going to have people who are saying, well, yeah, but you're reading it, but you're not playing it, and playing it is a wholly different experience. And that's true, but the only way to play it just like John is saying, when you go and sit down and play a game, you're really sitting down to a social interaction. You're sitting down to a party. Objectively, Monopoly is terrible. There is no reason anyone should play Monopoly. It is slow, boring, it's been solved already, it's just bad. But people still play it all the time, not because they like Monopoly, but because they like sitting down with their three friends and getting in long, boring arguments over housing rules. And so what we find ourselves in the position where we read these books and we don't have time to go out and test them and play them. We know that there are people who like everyone. Gosh, we've gotten that we did it. That was episode 87. And we've probably received 87 emails to that point where people send in a letter and say, oh, no, Haven's an amazing game. I played it for years with my friends. We threw out all the rules. But once we did that, we had the best time.
That's another thing also. I hear more and more, well, I guess it's been always like that, but game designers saying, oh, I want to create the perfect rules, or this rule is very annoying, and people being annoyed saying, oh, that rule's there. Just, I don't understand why people just don't throw them away, because that's all I did all the time. And now, after a couple decades after my first games of stuff like Star Wars D6, which is a game I love, and Nephilim also, rereading them before mastering them, I realized that we never applied just a third. We just applied a third of the rules, and that's fine. And that's why I'm not very interested when game designers tell me, I'm creating the best rule system. I'm like, yeah, okay, that's fine.
Yeah, well,
I mean, the rule system really, I mean, The thing with a lot of games is they usually include that, like, rule zero is if you don't like something, then you don't include it in your game. And I think for a lot of people, though, when you read through the rules, people look at it and go, but I can't deviate from that because those are the rules, and so I have to follow those. But you get, I don't think I've ever had a game, either personally or anyone I've ever heard of, that didn't have at least a couple house rules. No, I don't think I've ever heard anyone play a game straight out the box.
Now, granted, every time we say that on the air, because we've said that in a couple of different afterthoughts over the years, we get a few emails from people that say basically, oh, I've played first edition D&D 100% by the book. We've obeyed every rule. And I'm like, okay, that's fair, but I don't believe you, because it would take forever to play that game.
Oh, great. You're having fun? Yes? You're doing it right. Great. That's great
That is what we always say. And, you know, it sounds like it runs contradictory to what we do. When we say, please, play all these games. If you like the game, play it. You like Numenon, play Numenon. We didn't enjoy reading it. We thought it was, well, no, wait, we liked Numenon, didn't we?
Numenon was hilarious to read. I don't know that I'd ever play it.
Yeah. but any game you pick from at random from a wall, even if it's an objectively terrible game, I fully encourage people to go out and play it and have fun. The thing is, you're right. There, people are right. You can eliminate rules from these games and turn them into perfectly playable, just imagination exercises with their friends. They just become cooperative and creative storytelling, and that's wonderful. But there are thousands of role-playing games. If people had learned way back when it was just Chainmail and, you know, Tecumel, Empire of the Petal Throne and what have you, that you didn't need to use the rules in the book, that you were just using the story, then there'd be three role-playing games. There'd be a spy one, a science fiction one, and a dungeon one.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying to throw away the rules. I said that, and at the same time, I would never play Legends of the Five Rings with D20 rules or without rules. I don't like games without rules. I like the crunchiness of it. And actually, that episode of it's called La Cellule podcast, that French podcast, to name drop them. There are people, including game designers, and they like games which are much more narrative. And the main person, Romaric Briand, who's a figure of some kind, he's a person known in the French role-playing community, he was saying, oh yeah, but it's annoying because the rules are very crunchy. And the context is very, he called that aesthetic, narrativistic, and it's not compatible with the rules. But actually, personally, I like that friction because that's where it creates things which are random and which are real. But yeah, again, the potential of to find a book in a city or a village. They are in the French edition. I never use those things. There's a table. I never use the tables. So, I mean, I love tables. I'm a big defender of something like the mother of all encounter tables, and I love using it because I love random stuff. I say that.
Oh yeah.
As a game designer, as a game master, I like the randomness. Otherwise, I'm not playing. I like things to change. I like to have to improvise stuff, so I like these things, and I like the crunchiness, and I like in Legends of the Five Rings, oh, you've got your race system, etc. And on the other hand, I don't like. I'm not saying they're bad at all. I think it's a question of taste. I have trouble having fun with more recent indie games, which are supposedly works with most people, but not me. Helping you with the narrative stuff, personally, I find it gets in the way, and that's annoying me a bit.
Well, it's good. It's good that there's the variety out there. So, Calum, you probably know this about this show, but we split Afterthought up between a discussion period and a section where we ask or answer questions from our listeners. So would you like to join us? We have a stack of listener questions here.
Definitely. It's funny, I had a lot of things I was... first of all, I hope I didn't sound too much like a fanboy. It's difficult.
Don't worry about it.
And So yeah, just something to say. Since I think your episode's gonna be first, I had an announcement to make because I'm joining the RPG Academy.
Oh, good for you!
That's awesome. That's great that I will be doing stuff which... that was my objective this year with the show, to do more stuff with fellow podcasters. And it's great to record with you right now and now to do more of that with RPG Academy as well.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. Yeah, we are currently in the market, as it were. We're still an independent podcast at the moment.
We know several of the people that are in that network. Some good friends actually that are in that RPG Academy network. So
yeah, isn't that,
they're great guys.
Isn't that Swallows of the South? Aren't they? Yeah. So we have friends in the RPG Academy network. So that's great. Congratulations. We actually have a similar goal this year of trying to get out there a little more and connect with other shows because it's fun. It's fun to
this idea of having also commoners, regular listeners, poor people, mortals, just come and talk about just that question you raise all the time. How were people actually playing that game? And that's great if you take the initiative to get people on the show to discuss that in the aftertow.
Absolutely. So I think we're going to go ahead and start with a couple of questions. You know, we've been saving one that showed up a few days ago because it's perfect for this conversation. So I am going to launch in with our first one. This one's to a regular listener of ours, Ryan Marshall. And he asks, what's your general experience been like with games that are translated from a foreign language? Have you ever been reading a book and not been able to understand the rules because a wonky translation made the game mechanics unclear? Are there any games that come to mind which have suffered from particularly poor translations? I've just about given up on translated games entirely, since they all seem to suffer from this to varying degrees, but I don't know how widespread it really is. So, just speaking for us, and we'll just do this real quick, because I'm way more interested in your answer. We haven't actually played one that I'm aware of. We've read a couple. Maid is translated from Japanese. Of course, Nephilim is translated from French. I believe there are others that are translated in our library, but you can usually tell. There were some things in the Nephilim translation that were looked like they just gave up on the word and let it slide through. I actually do speak a tiny bit of French, so for me it wasn't that bad. But Maid was notably translated from Japanese and had a lot of weird rule issues. But you, I'm guessing, since English isn't your first language, means that most games you read were clearly translated.
But the thing is, the main game I would have read which was translated was Legend of the Five Rings, and it's funny because role-playing game often they do more than, well, ideally they do more than translating, and Legend of the Five Rings, they expanded the games, they created scenarios which they included in the way of supplements, etc. So this was a really great one. The one I've heard, which is a bit infamous, I didn't read it myself, was the French translation of, I think it's called in English, The Black Eye. It's a German game, Schwarzauge. Yeah. And apparently the translation in many places is word by word. And we're talking about something very recent. And apparently it's extremely, extremely dreadful.
Well, now I just want to find it.
Well, yeah, that's actually it is a huge German RPG. And I've been wanting to see if we could find an English translation of it to be able to do it. But yeah, I have heard some things for the translations on that.
All right. Let's see.
Yeah, it's a real job. I mean, translating role-playing games, translating something is already very difficult. I do this a lot for my work, and it's architecture stuff. So there's stuff we just don't translate. So there's no word in French for stuff like design or placemaking, which are words, which are common in here in England. But they don't exist in French. And in French, they would say stuff which... and they got weird habits, like never saying client or things like that. And doing a tabletop RPG, that's even more complicated. And the thing you notice is when a word has been translated, like a skill has been translated with a different word several times. Like you would have fast talk being translated as baratin or lie, mentir, and so on.
Yeah, basically barrage of lies type stuff instead.
Oh, by the way, I check, and second edition fails at your test. It says seduction of opposite genders only.
Thank you for letting us know. That was not in the first edition English translation. We didn't. I don't know that we mentioned it specifically, but there wasn't even a seduction skill.
Yeah, I checked. It wasn't there. That was weird.
Yeah. But yeah, that's if people are listening for the first time and don't know what that is, I routinely, when I read RPGs, the first thing I do is check to see if the game's got a seduction mechanic and if the seduction mechanic specifies that it only works on the opposite sex. It's three extra words you could easily remove from any RPG to suddenly make the RPG a lot more inclusive. And it's weird that people don't feel like they need to put those extra three words in there.
The fourth edition succeeded, but then I personally find the fourth edition is dreadful. But
we still talking about Nephilim? That's the dreadful one?
Yeah, the fourth one is really weird. You've got the skills in five different places, the character creation in five different places. They split it by elements, and it's so weird. Oh. And so it's really a high-level concept idea from the game designer, I guess, but it makes it horrible to read.
Yeah, yeah. Layout is a tricky wicket when it comes to properly designing games. And we've of course, seen a number of games that try to split character creation so it eats up the entire first book they put out. And it can be infuriating when you're trying to make a character and you're like, all right.
Oh, yeah. Every time we get to the bonus content, you're like, all right, I'm making a character. All right, I need to do this thing. Okay, where is that in the book?
Yeah. So that's disappointing. Yeah. Maybe one of these days we'll get around to it, although I'm assuming that's the active edition.
As a result, I think second edition is still more active, to be honest.
Hey, it's the same with D&D. All right. Next question comes to us from Rocksteady Roll Hard, and he says, I know you guys have answered questions about RPGs and musicals before, but let's get weird with it. If you could make a hip-hop musical in the style of Hamilton about any signature character from an RPG setting, who would it be?
Hmm.
This is interesting because I'm a huge Hamilton fan and listen to it pretty much every other day at work. And John, for some reason, likes every musical in the world but Hamilton.
Yeah. I don't know. It's not like it was bad. I just listened to it and went, eh.
But that's fine. We're still doing a hip-hop right here, John. So a hip-hop musical.
The only problem I have with this is I don't care about signature characters in basically any RPG. Every time there's a signature character, I'm like, man, I don't care about you. This is a game about the players.
I'll do it then. I'm going to go with that. I don't remember her name. I think it's Sione, and she's the Pathfinder core sorcerer character. I want a whole musical explaining her pants situation.
That pants situation.
Because she's got like stirrups tied on but she's like not quite wearing pants. She's wearing like strappy roby things, but then she has some like lower pants, just like the bottom cuffs of pants that are attached.
She couldn't get her pants any lower, so she put two little pairs of pants on her legs.
Yes, that's and I want a full explanation in hip hop form that explains her fashion decision.
I think I would go for my very favorite character of all RPG, but I think it would be great for a big mega production. I don't know if you know who is Kaya Adrimetrum.
I do not know that one.
So Kaya Adrimetrum is the main character which you can play in the Darkstrider campaign, Star Wars D6 campaign. But and she's in charge of a Corellian corvette, which has been fitted to be like an aircraft carrier with X-wings, etc. So she could have hip-hop scenes on the decks of the Corellian corvette, and as the X-wing are flying, etc. And they don't know. She's got a very diverse crew also, so that could make a lot of different musical scenes.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Okay, now I actually have one. I just remembered. Definitely want to do a Hamilton style musical about the Prosek family from Rifts.
Ooh.
That rise to fascist power within the Prosek family.
Oh man, you could have like two whole songs about the skull motif.
Right?
Yeah, all right. I'm on board for that.
Have some Skelebot dancers.
Oh, dude, yes, some Skelebot dancers. I'm on board for either of yours. I think mine's just one song, but you guys have whole musicals ready to go.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to a question from Neil Anderson. And Neil Anderson asks, and this is a very simple one, what recent RPG do you play? So it's got to be one that came out recently, stopping us from being all old-fashioned.
Well, I mean, for us, we are in an Exalted 3rd Edition campaign, so that is probably the most recent thing that we've played.
Yeah, it's an ongoing game. They managed to get a whole one book out.
They did. They managed to get that book out, though. I mean, 2 years late, but it's there.
Yeah. What about you, Callum? What are you playing these days?
I think I've got the most boring one. Just like if you ask Ice Cream, it will be Vanilla. It will be Dungeons & Dragons 5. That's the only recent one I play. I don't play that many recent games, to be honest.
No, that's fine. That's a lot of people these days. I mean,
well, yeah. Once you find an RPG you actually like, there's, you know, no real incentive to change it out.
Yeah. I mean, if I was still playing any D&D, I'd still be playing 4th edition because it's my favorite. But there's no mandate that says you have to jump ship when a new ship becomes available.
That's a difficult industry for that.
That is true. That's why people have to innovate when they come out with new role-playing games. You have to offer something new and not just a repackaging. But yeah, so we've got a couple people playing Exalted 3rd Edition, someone playing 5th Edition D&D. I've actually, one of the things I do for fun, which is ridiculous because my whole life is reading old RPGs, is I read new ones just to pass the time and then don't review them. So I am currently reading my way through Shadowrun Anarchy, the fast play version of Shadowrun that just came out. I am not liking it very much.
Oops.
But, you know, it's interesting to see what their idea was. And there are, like you were saying earlier, Callum, when you were talking about games that have that try to help people control the narrative correctly. That's pretty much the only new thing this brought to Shadowrun, is this kind of take turns telling the story, pass the conch, everyone gets to control the NPCs vibe, which is fascinating and can lead to an interesting game, but you still end up rolling handfuls of dice against other handfuls of dice, and that doesn't lead to a fast play version of something.
Yeah, it's like those things now, I'm going to talk ill of a coming game from France, but these things where you've got tokens as the game master, which you can use against your players to change the situation, and the players got tokens also to shape the situation. And I was thinking, when would I find the time to manage all these tokens while I'm game mastering and just trying to work out what crazy idea answer I'm going to give to my players?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the token mechanic is weird when you're the DM, because you're like, I have full control of this game.
I already have the full control of what's going on. I don't need a token to tell me that I can change something.
Yeah, here's a cookie for you.
Shadowrun actually does that as well. Whenever you spend a glitch token to control the narrative as a player, the DM gets that glitch token, and then they can use it later to wrest control again, which is... It's just weird. I mean, it's not the weirdest. We've seen games where the DM earns experience.
Well, yeah, I think it's really those mechanics where they're trying to make it so that the DM feels like they're playing instead of everyone else is playing while you're trying to herd them along.
Yeah. So it's interesting because those sorts of mechanics look really smart when you're reading your way through the book.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, oh, that'll totally involve the GM. And then when you're running the game, you're like, oh, I don't need any of this.
I barely have time to make the experience point to my players on my 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons, so starting to get an experience point for my NPC, I know. Thank you very much.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Next question comes to us from Snowbound. And, oh, this is some recent American storyline stuff, so here we go. When is it acceptable to punch Nazis? And there are two questions about Nazi punching, so I'll just say the other one came to us from Gaming Hipster. When is it acceptable to punch Nazis? Not people I vociferously disagree with or people who may associate with Nazis. Actual, literal, my race is inherently superior and the law should enforce this. Nazis. And that comes to us. Oh, it's actually from Nikki Cheese.
Ah. Oh, Nikki.
Nikki Cheese.
Did you see the chart? Actually, it's been answered with the Dungeons & Dragons alignment chart recently over Twitter.
Yeah, I saw that on Twitter.
I also saw the flow chart.
Yeah.
Which is mostly just, is the Nazi within punching distance? No, move closer.
I don't like any answer that has me moving closer to a Nazi.
Yeah, that's true.
just incidental. That's enough for me. Can I punch a Nazi right now? Yes, punch Nazi. Go 210. You know, it's funny because people keep trying to get this show to be a political show. But, man... Speaking as someone who is, you know, a Californian bisexual Democratic sort of person, the state that the United States is in right now is absolutely terrifying. People are using the tools that we've laid down for centuries in our country to protect free speech, to instead protect fascism, and it's horrible, and the seeds have been there for so long in message boards and chat rooms. This is the eventual outgrowth of what like 8chan and /poll and stuff like that are. They're breeding grounds where people learn that it's okay to be just assholes. They start with thinking it's funny. They're like, oh, I talk like Cartman from South Park. Ha ha, I get a laugh out of this. And in about 10 years, they're like, oh my God, you Nazis are my only friends.
Yeah.
And it's horrible to watch it happen. It's horrible that we're in this situation, and the end result is it's always okay to resist. It is never a bad time to resist Nazism, fascism, racism, anything. Resistance is always okay, and punching is just resistance.
Yeah.
Right, John?
Yes.
Yeah. And what do you think?
Did you ask me? Did you? Oh, so,
yeah. There you go.
I would just react. Just say you mentioned a lot of internet platforms. I would say I think it applies to the US also, but being from the UK, because I consider this place my home now, the mass media are not extremely. They are not clear of guilt in that thing. We've got the. No. The mass media here in the UK, which has been blowing on the embers for ages, you've heard about Brexit. They've been saying, "Oh yeah, you should vote against Brexit," but at the same time, they've been using and misinforming people very badly on a number of subjects, and they still do. And the immigrants are still the scapegoats, etc. Why it's just ridiculous. So I would say it's certainly not just the internet which is to blame. There's also real issues in the life of people which have not been dealt with. And I think, well, yeah, I don't want to make this into, I don't know, Piers Morgan or whatever. But yeah, you watch CNN and you watch the bad job a lot of people. The real crisis in Europe and probably in the US also is that people who are supposedly representing a number of values just didn't and failed, and we have to pay. It's always the same person who pay the tab in the end, and that's a pity. But yeah, definitely resist. And by the way, I apologize if I unfollowed anyone on Twitter. I won't apologize to certain people who are advocating for certain stuff, but I will apologize for people even advocating for things I would agree with. It's just when on Twitter with the podcast, I personally, I've got another Twitter for that, and I just try to change my mind, and it's getting more and more difficult. Resist. We need to resist. We need to be in the street. We need to use the democratic tools, etc. And what were you saying about this podcast, System Mastery, not turning too political?
We've never been in a, I mean, there's a lot of social stuff that we've talked about on the show over the years, because, of course, I've spent all my time rallying people into realizing how kind of sexist and racist a lot of the older games are.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, but that's as far as I've ever really wanted to push it. I don't want to make this show about, oh God, Donald Trump. I've even stopped doing that. We used to do that we'll build a wall joke over and over again. I've stopped doing it. This is a place where I come to get away from the rest of my stupid country right now. And so for me, that part of and the other thing is, we're on the internet. We're on Twitter. The more we talk about politics, the more we draw the eye of Sauron. and before you know it, we'll have 5,000 slash poll idiots just saying things that don't even make sense to us. I don't need to be called a cuck every couple of minutes. I'm good.
Yeah.
So that's where we're at. We're trying to keep it small and friendly, and we love our community, and that's just the way we want to keep it.
Yeah, and resist, and the difficult bit, and I think we're all there, is to try to find what we can actually do, and renting online is probably not the most useful way. So let's involve ourselves in movements or organization, even writing a letter. So often people underestimate the power that might have with your representative, whatever their party.
That is true. That's very true. Yeah. I mean, for us, we've mostly kept it to social stuff. I mean, there are not a lot of queer voices in gaming, in the podcasting world. I mean, there's more than I think, but I get the occasional email from people that are like, it's nice to have someone who's, queer in any way talking about role-playing games, because it connects to my experience. There's a lot of folks who, especially people my age, who are like, oh, it's amazing how homophobic gaming tables are. It's just kind of, nerds are historically terrible people, and it's nice to know that that's something that's changing. So let's move on before we get too maudlin. Next question from Mirdra Deck, and he says, "Hello, fine fellows at System Mastery. I have two questions." Oh, here we go. This is the kind of thing I like. Would you rather have sex with a beholder, a mind flayer, or an aboleth?
What's the last one? I don't know.
An aboleth. Aboleth is a slimy, giant, three-eyed fish that lives deep in the Underdark and turns its victims, by way of poisoning them, into what are called scum, with a K, that are basically slime zombies. and they are powerfully psychic.
Sounds wet.
I've got to go with Beholder because, I mean, really, there's only the one hole on the Beholder at this point. So
that's true.
Which brings up the question: how does a Beholder poop? Does a Beholder eat?
I don't think they eat.
Okay, because I don't think I've ever actually given it much thought. But I'm like, you know, Beholder, I don't think they've got a butt.
Well,
you know.
let's break that down real quick, because have we ever seen, is have you ever seen the back of a Beholder? Because the art of them is always from the front.
Oh, yeah. I've seen the whole thing. It's too late. I've seen everything.
I think in the back they got a blonde toupee.
It's just got a wig back there. It's just a wig and a flap, like a mud flap. You know, like it's got like Wile E. Coyote on it.
Hey man, I've had little Beholder figurines.
Okay,
spin
fair
those
enough.
Around. You can see the whole thing.
Yeah.
But those are based on the sculpting of people who have never seen the back of a Beholder.
Well, I mean, technically, given that they don't exist,
yeah.
No one has seen the front of a Beholder either.
I'm just saying, I'm guessing the back of a Beholder is a lot of butt. There's probably a...
just a lot of butt.
Just like, and like a human-shaped
super
butt,
junk.
Too. Like, there's cheeks, the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
Hairy
Nobody
cheeks.
Nobody twerks like a Beholder.
Hairy cheeks. So let's see.
Yeah, the toilet, the pooping thing is interesting because as an architect, I have big troubles looking at dungeon maps because remind me the last time you saw some toilets in the dungeon maps. Each time I look at that, I'm like, yeah, but where do people sleep? Where do people go put the dishes, etc.?
I don't know. I mean, granted, there's not a lot of people in the average dungeon, but you know, the orcs and
I mean,
what
they a lot of the times you'll when you, especially when you get those adventures where it's like, go into these goblin warrens. You're like, man, there's just nothing here. How do they live here?
How is this? Yeah, this doesn't. Well, they just poop wherever. They're goblins.
They poop in the corners.
They don't.
Oh, they go in the corners. These are those must be hobgoblins. All right. So the question was a Beholder, a mind flayer, or an aboleth. I'm going to go with a mind flayer because it's humanoid.
Okay.
That's kind of where I kind of know the basic operations with a mind flayer. I'm like, all right, your stuff's kind of where I figure it should be.
Yeah, but I mean, Beholder, man, you got to climb up on that weird big old ball and just ride that around. That is great.
Yeah, well, okay, first of all.
And he's going to want you to pull its eye stalks.
I was just, riding it around is a weird concept of sex for you. I'm not sure where that's coming from.
Well, because he floats. I mean, come on now.
All right.
You don't know if it throws lasers when it's excited also, something like that. That might be dangerous. I think Mind Flayer is definitely the best because aren't those things telepathic? So they might project whatever you want to come to their means.
Yeah. That's where I'm at. I'm on board with the Mind Flayer. My only fear with the Mind Flayer is that it might be like having sex with a praying mantis.
Yeah, it's definitely going to eat your brain when you're done.
Yeah, like you're going to get eaten afterwards.
Yeah.
I think that's a problem. I think we can all basically say no on the aboleth because it's going to turn you into a slime zombie by touching you.
Yeah. Well, plus that's...
It's similar to John. You can't touch John without turning into a slime zombie.
You're going
to
get some slime on you. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
It seems like you're going to die anyway, whatever the three of them. So it's sort of your last shot of having a blast. So yeah, Mind Flayer.
Mind Flayer. Okay. Two Mind Flayer, one Beholder.
Yep.
All right. And then we have a second question from him. And this is weird. Please explain the following Nelly lyrics from the song Shake Ye Tail Feather. All right, here we go. These are the lyrics, and we have to explain these. What your name is, where you from, turn around, who you came with, is that your ass, or your mama half reindeer?
Okay, so, I mean, the beginning lyrics, very self-explanatory. He wants to know who this person is, did they come here with anyone, or are they alone? You know, very normal questions, trying to get to know someone.
Yeah, those are regular club pickup questions. I think, really, it's going to boil down to the is your mama half reindeer part.
Yeah. I don't know what he's trying to get at there. Do reindeers have notoriously large butts? Is that a thing?
Sexy? Because I'm picturing reindeer, and what I'm picturing is that they've got that white butt, you know, like the brown fur, but the white upturned fur on the back.
Yeah.
You like that, do you?
It's not winning me over dramatically, no.
Maybe she's wearing, like, white booty shorts, so it's just white there.
Well, okay, the other thing I really like to break down here is that he's saying at best, that she, the girl here, is one quarter reindeer.
Yeah, one quarter reindeer. So just little nubbins for horns.
Well, okay, it might be possible that she's three quarters reindeer.
Might be.
Because if her mom is half reindeer and her dad is just a reindeer.
Yeah.
Then yeah, she's three quarters reindeer. Maybe that's why he's asking. He's like, what? Why is there a reindeer here?
Why is there a weird, like, Cronenbergian reindeer human hybrid?
So here's my suggestion for what's happening in this is that
she is slowly crawling across the ground and putting his shotgun to her head.
Yeah,
and that's what's happening.
It's 100% reindeer, except for her front hooves are human hands. So he's like, what the hell is this thing? Who brought this thing in here? That's what's happening. Who brought in this weird monster? Someone turn it around. I want to see the full extent of its horror. Wait, is its mom half reindeer? Because obviously its father is 100% reindeer. That's the only situation that would explain this.
Yeah, that is clearly it.
I think there's probably an anime somewhere out there which described that situation much better.
That's probably right, yeah. Oh my gosh. So our answer is that Nelly is asking why a reindeer monster is in the club.
Why is this strange Cronenbergian reindeer monster in this club?
Yeah.
Why does it keep begging me to end its suffering?
There we go. All right. I think we got time for one more. We're going to have to do a big question series next week, John. Here we go.
Nope.
I'm just trying to pick one. There are dozens, and I love everyone for sending them in, but I want to make sure.
I love each one. All my children.
Well, we're going to get to all of them eventually. Okay, I'm going to go with this one. This one comes to us from Eric McNaughton, and he says, I'm sorry, from Sir Phobos. This question comes to us from Sir Phobos, who asks, you can choose any one painter throughout all of history to illustrate one of your RPGs. Which artist do you pick, and what RPG do they illustrate?
Huh.
So any painter throughout all of history to illustrate any RPG, he says that we reviewed, but since we've got a guest, I'm just going to expand it to any RPG.
Man, I'm going to have to go.
You reviewed my game. Guess what it is?
Well, you're going to say Nephilim. That's fine. That's okay, but you have to pick a painter.
It's very easy also. I think it's actually in some of the books. Jerome Bosch.
Oh yeah,
Flemish. It's exactly Nephilim. It's full of symbols.
We're talking about Jerome Bosch, not Hieronymus.
Jerome Bosch.
Okay. All right. I was like, I can see Hieronymus Bosch doing a lot of. But okay, Jerome Bosch doing Nephilim. What do you got, John?
Okay, I am 100% going with Numenon with art by Salvador Dali.
Ooh.
Nice.
Okay, that's good. And I'm going to say Gamma World, and I would like the art to be done by Roger Dean.
Okay.
I mean, granted, these jokes aren't going to land for people unless they know who these artists are.
Yeah, that's so fine.
It's nice to educate yourself. Politics, culture, everything in system mastery. But I think we're doing it the wrong way because we're trying to find artists which are in tune with the games. We should do the opposite. Gamma World. I like that. Who would be, Delacroix, someone very classic for Gamma World and something very crazy for...
Get some Monet.
Okay, yeah. All right, I'd like to see a Vermeer take on Gamma World. It's just going to be a bunch of severe, kind of dark pictures of, like, Yetis.
Man, what I want is the Dark Heresy book, that Warhammer 40K RPG.
Yeah.
But I want it with old caveman paintings and just like stick figures of people fighting orcs.
So you want like the Lascaux cave art?
Yes, that is exactly what I want.
With like the Sisters of Battle done as like pendulous breasts and giant hips?
Yeah, that's all I need is just super old-timey art for that.
I think I go then with something like Cops or Paranoia, but by Picasso.
Ooh. Yeah, okay. I could see that. That, you know, I always think of the Paranoia RPG when I'm looking at Guernica, so that makes sense to me.
Well, I always think of Guernica when I'm reading Paranoia.
Man, Now, that's true. I want to say that at cocktail parties now. It's like, oh yes, Guernica. Everyone focuses on the horse in the center of the frame, of course. But to me, it smacks of the late 80s RPG paranoia. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need another sip from my snifter of wine cooler. I'd also like to see how Botticelli would draw drow. I've always been a fan of Botticelli's work. I like his long the long fingers and the way everyone looks like Greek nudes and so on. So I'd like to see his take on some Menzo Baranzan style drow.
Some Warhammer 40k by Andy Warhol.
Ooh.
Like Prince of the Emperor in different colors.
Yeah, I could see that. That little Andy Warhol. That definitely makes sense. Yeah, they have like four pictures of the Empire or the Emperor, and they're all like done in the soup can color style. Yeah, that's good. I like that. We could also probably get like a couple of 15 to 20 minute short films where like a space marine is meticulously and slowly putting his own armor on. All right, so we are running right out of time here. So what I need to do, and it's only fair, is to turn to you, Kalom, from the Rolis podcast and give you a chance to plug your show. So why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners all about that and where they can find it.
Okay, so if you want to hear the truth about Nephilim, which is a great game, in a couple of months there should be an episode about that. But otherwise, the Rolis podcast is a show a bit more about role players themselves and how different their walk of life can be. It's broadly based in London, so it started by revolving around a very niche community of French-speaking role players based in London and what they did, where they came from, and it slowly expanded towards other clubs in London, and even we went to Washington, we went to Barcelona, and we interview people. If you're looking for a show where someone was in a market in Barcelona, found two people from the States, from Utah, and asked them if they knew what Dungeons & Dragons is, completely at random, I think I'm the only one on the internet who ever did that.
I think that's a great idea. I like that a lot as a podcast concept. I mean, we did our whole thing by saying, let's copy the bad movie podcasts, you know, like your How Did This Get Made and what have you. But a lot of people, when they make this decision to get into the podcast game with role-playing, is the first thought is, oh, people would love our D&D campaign. And, you know, maybe that's true, but I always like people who examine the margins of the industry, the writers, or in your case, the players, which is a great idea. So definitely make sure you check out the Rolis podcast. Where can people find that?
It can be found on iTunes, on any good podcast app. I think I might need to spell it. So Rollist, that's the French word for role player. So it's Rolists, the Rolist. We've got a website. So if you type Rolist Pod, you'll find me on Instagram, Twitter, and you probably find the website as well. And we got music in the show. We got loads of stuff. It's really, really random. We got episodes dedicated to food, episode dedicated to God knows what. And actually, I got a suggestion for you guys. I got an episode about a French game called In Nomine Satanis, who's got an infamous translation to English.
Yeah, yeah, we've been looking for that.
So actually, this one, unlike Nephilim, if you go ahead and have a look at it and you trash it, I'm sure you'll find a lot, you'll make a lot of French role players happy. And I can come back and discuss it and do another plug and get more of your sweet Patreon followers.
Yeah, by all means, anyone who's following our Patreon, please go ahead and support his instead, because as you probably know, we recently hit our $500 goal, so we have to cover Fatal right now.
Oh, dare you. Oh, dare you go take them there. That's horrible. Otherwise, I was forgetting the RPG Academy, of course. I should be mentioned, yeah. And there should be a link on their website, so go there. It's even easier to find.
Yeah, absolutely. Check out RPG Academy. Check out the Rolis podcast with Kalom here. Once again, just wanted to say thanks very much for coming by and letting us know all the ways we're wrong about Nephilim.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
You're not wrong. You're just an asshole.
Okay, that was a bit not very nice what you said about me at the end of the episode, and you did not even name drop me. So that was not cool.
Well, I guess so,
we had this guy. He kept tweeting that he loved this game and it was awesome. I don't think it was somebody else that me. And you did not even name my show. That's
well. Let's. I mean, cool. I probably should have said release, but let's be fair. At the time, I probably would have called you by your real name.
Yeah, good you didn't, because it's a big secret and it's impossible to find on the internet.
Well, anyway, my apologies. We were deep into anger by the end of that episode. We get on these tracks.
I'm teasing you. You know, if yeah, it's, I don't care. I mean, any publicity is good publicity for Nephilim. I mean, so no, but seriously, you go see old games. You might be a bit harsh on them, according to some people. But in the end, I think you bring these to the attention of a lot of people, which might seize them, adapt them because they like an idea or a concept in it, and you bring them back to the light.
I can confirm for you that even one of our more famous episodes, the Haven City of Violence we did, I've received more than once letters from people saying, after your review, where you absolutely hated this game and everything about it, we decided to play it, and we've been playing it for like 6 months.
Wow.
So people take what they want out of what we do, and that's good. That's the way it should be. So, Kalom, once again, thank you very much for joining us today.
And thanks for having me.
Yeah. And as always, we have been the System Mastery Podcast, doing our Afterthought episode this week. You can find us at SystemMasteryPodcast.com or System Mastery on Gmail, Facebook, or Twitter. Send us your Afterthought questions at SystemMastery@gmail.com or by visiting the r/SystemMastery subreddit on Reddit. That's a great place to get them. We have really, really good folks and listeners on Reddit who have been organizing questions for us and organizing the movie recommendations. That has just been the best. So once again, thank you to our Reddit subscribers and listeners. Otherwise, thanks so much for listening. Thanks very much to Kalom from the Rolis Podcast for joining us today. And we will see you in a week with a new System Mastery episode. Thanks so much. Have a good week.